Okay, so last week I got as far, I was still in military history, the first big field, military and diplomatic history, and I was explaining how for the first generation at least, the question of the ordinary soldier was not so important. So you did get some publication of diaries, poems, and then on the other hand you got official history. You know, why did we win or why did we lose in the German case? Who was to blame? Which generals were good generals, which generals were bad generals? Which diplomats were good diplomats, which diplomats were bad diplomats, and so on. But military history, to continue, has become very much, very popular today, military history from below. And I mentioned this one. I don't know why we have only half of this. Let's see if I can solve that. Nope. Richard Holmes, Tommy. There are two sides to this. There's university history and how much they're interested in this. But also, in Britain, at least, this is you can sell millions of books. And this is a very popular book, 1,000 pages and a bestseller, which is not easy for a history book. Very serious book, very good book. The British soldier, about ordinary soldiers and what their life was like. I mentioned that one then, a particular story of one person in the story. I think I looked at all these last week, Unknown Soldiers, Trench Warfare, and I finished with that one. And this is the one where the gentleman wanted to look at the system of avoiding war when you're at war. Another important book is by a woman called Ilana Bet-El. And the name of her book is Conscripts. A very important contribution because in Britain, the myth of the First World War, we always see films about the volunteers, the heroes, the volunteers, because at the beginning of the war, you only joined the army if you want. You were not obliged by law to join the army. Now, and this has been exaggerated to some extent, you know, the enthusiastic workers going to join the army. And it's not completely untrue. It's possible to show you many, many letters from people saying, oh, I am really happy to join the army. Now, of course, afterwards you have to understand that their life at work was very hard and very boring. Yeah? You live in the same, you live in one street and you go to the factory next door for 5 years, from 14 years old, for 5 years, 10 years, 50. You know, perhaps joining the army appeared to be interesting, and many other elements as well. Of course, today we have seen so many war films. We have an image of the war. How many war films have these people seen? None. Or almost none. Yeah? They had very little image of war. They knew about death. People died at home. Yeah? People died at home and stayed at home. Yeah? Whereas today, we probably know less about death, but a lot more about war. Yeah? So there's also other elements. If you were in prison, and a lot of people are in prison, you can leave prison if you join the army. So it's not exactly volunteers. They're not all exactly volunteers. You know, you have a choice. You can stay in prison or join the army. It's not exactly volunteers. But what Ilana Bet-El wanted to say is that we forget the conscripts, but in fact, more than half the British soldiers in the First World War were conscripts. I think it's 53%, something like that. But nevertheless, more than half. So that means that for 2 years of the biggest propaganda campaign in history, join the army, it's wonderful, moral pressure, etc., and the majority of men did not. So that's also something that needs understanding and why that happened. And so she looked at the conscripts and she wanted to try to understand them. How did they feel? Did they feel like soldiers? They were civilian soldiers. Did they feel like soldiers? How did they? What happened to them? Training, going to France mostly, etc. There's another interesting thing about Ilana Bet-El. What's the other interesting thing about this historian? Unusual.
She's
She's a woman. How many women military historians do you have? Yeah, not so many. Not so many. There are more now. Lynn MacDonald is a big military historian of the First World War, a woman. Ilana Bettel. Makes an interesting question. Does it make a difference? That's an interesting question. Do women historians write history differently? I don't know, but an interesting question to ask. Staying with this idea of military history from below, more and more memoirs and diaries were published. So these are, in some ways, they are books of history, but in some ways they're not necessarily history books. It's just the diary of the memoirs of a machine gunner on the Western Front. They sometimes have very interesting elements. For example, I think it's this gentleman who said, "I always tried to shoot at their legs because I didn't want to kill anybody." Yeah? Interesting elements. But also you can see that they're also supposed to be exciting books. You can see they made the cover with the bullet holes in it. It's let's sell it on the excitement side of it and so on. There are quite a lot of diaries. Slightly different ones. So this one, Drawing Fire, the Diary of a Great War Soldier and Artist. Yeah, he joined the army, but he was also an artist, and it's, what happened to him in this way. The First World War is so popular in publishing circles that you can sell any diary, but it should be a little different. But that's generally the case if you want to sell anything. It should be a little different. I will put this up on the thing. My Diary of the Great War. I don't know what was particular about that gentleman. Yeah, military history from below diaries became more and more popular, and they're still going. There's another one. A priest, a chaplain, a priest. The priests were a very interesting sector of the population. Of course, because we think of there being a contradiction between Christianity and war, to some extent, we think of it, we imagine there to be. And so how did they react when they were going to war with the army, but they didn't fight, they didn't have guns, the chaplains? How did that work? And some of the great war diaries. So all of these things interest people, and this is in association with the museum, the Imperial War Museum, which is the major war museum in London, and which is surprisingly open-minded. It's not as imperial as you imagine. They did a big exhibition on the history of pacifists in Britain a few years ago. They do very interesting things. You imagine it be. In fact, the Musée des Invalides is much more traditionalist than the Imperial War Museum, despite its name. Imperial sounds pretty traditional. So the diaries, and just to give you a little example, this one is in French. I don't know why have I got this in French. I don't know. I must have translated it myself at some point. En sortant, nous arrivons à une tranchée bien construite. À chaque mètre, il s'y trouve un soldat britannique mort, tué en sortant de la tranchée pour l'attaque. 20 mètres devant, un rang de soldats britanniques, alignés comme pour une parade, les sous-officiers en position, et quelques mètres devant, le commandant du peloton, un revolver rouillé dans la main, son sifflet dans l'autre, tous donc massacrés par la mitrailleuse. Nous voyons deux soldats, un Anglais et un Fritz, morts à un mètre l'un de l'autre. Le Fritz est transpercé au niveau du cou par une baïonnette britannique, tandis que l'Anglais est coupé en deux, et une baïonnette allemande sort de son dos. Just to give you a little flavour of the joyful aspect of this. The diary is very, 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 very interesting to read, the diaries, and at the same time, when you read a lot of them, I've read a lot of them, you say, there's something missing here. Every diary, my friend was killed. Lots of other things happened. My friend was killed. I got wounded. Every diary. And then you look to... Nobody seems to have killed anybody. Where does the diary... And then I killed a... No. This is not 100% true. But in general, you have all these diaries full of people dying but not killing. Now, this is not possible. It's mathematically impossible. Yeah? But it says... And it doesn't mean that they're lying. It means that psychologically, the whole thing is... is very, very difficult. So when you get to the diary, and this is the case in any history book, what is missing? That's always a big question, what is missing? That's how you understand things. So we're still talking about military history from below, and this continues to be extremely popular today, and many, many books written, and so many, many books bought. But you have to do something new, because you don't want to do the same work again. And one of the options has been to write books about particular groups within the military. For example, this one, Richard van Emden, is one of the big writers of this kind of book. Boy Soldiers of the Great Book, of the Great War, their own stories for the first time. And there's a few things that you notice here. First of all, when you look at a book about the First World War, very often it says, for the first time, the untold story. This partly has an element of marketing. Yeah? You can't sell a book saying, here's the story that you have read 100 times before. Yeah? You've got to do that to some extent. Richard Van Emden, and Boy Soldiers, the youngest soldier, I think I mentioned, the youngest British soldier killed was 13. There were many 14-year-olds. In theory, that you had to be 17 to join the army and 19 to go to France. In fact, and there's some very very moving stories told there of what happened when the sergeant discovered that a soldier was only 12. Sometimes they send them home. Not unusually, quite a number of younger soldiers joined the army, and then a few weeks later, their mother came with the birth certificate and said, look, you must let him leave the army because he's not so old. So the boy wanted to join the army, but the mother or the father could stop them. Okay, so the boy, and you can see that they do really look pretty young. Now, I can't quite remember what's in this. I think this is, but I can't remember the sources used there, so I can't tell you more about that. Conscripts, I mentioned that a moment ago. So again, here we are focusing in on particular groups of people. Yeah, particular groups of people, because you can learn more about particular groups of people. There's not a lot of things you can say about soldiers in general. Some of them volunteers, some of them old, some of them young, some of them from India, some of them from England. Yeah, it's good to be able to focus in. And there's a lot of these. Sometimes unusual groups. We will not fight the untold story. The untold story. It's always the untold story of World War I's conscientious objectors. Surprisingly, when they brought in the law in 1916, which said all men under 30, later on 49, at the end of 49, all men must join the army. They also said, if you have a conscientious objection, a tribunal can decide that you don't have to join the army. This was very surprising, really. In France, there was no conscientious objection. Was considered to be, and at that time, in the Second World War, perhaps, I'm not sure. The tribunal was not very friendly. If you could prove that you were a religious person and that you had always been a pacifist, you were okay. If you had political reasons and not religious reasons, in general, the tribunal was not going to agree. Now, what could the tribunal do? If they accepted you a conscientious objector, then you were allowed to join a non-combatant corps. For example, ambulance driver or something. Still dangerous, yeah? But some of the conscientious objectors saying, no, I refuse to do any work for the war. Driving ambulances helps the war, and I refuse to drive ambulances. And they were sent to prison. And at the beginning of the war, they threatened to shoot them. In fact, they didn't shoot them. But it was, they almost shot them. They were very lucky. It was the last moment. And let's say that they weren't treated very well in prison. I think you can imagine that. It's not the friendliest place. In fact, many people just did not understand the possibility. It was impossible for many people to understand. So, interesting story of a particular group. This is another book about priests, padres. The padre is the military chaplain, the priest attached to the military. So all these books about particular groups, military history from below, particular groups within the military, now conscientious objectors. Well, in fact, they are in a way within the military because they're dealt with by for military reasons. Or otherwise, if the historian didn't feel like studying particular groups, they could study particular experiences. Yeah, so something particular that happened to people. Not all of these experiences were very nice. British military executions in the West Great War. A certain number of soldiers were executed, sometimes for running away. It's kind of scary, yeah, you run away, you get away from, you're in France somewhere, yeah, you try to hide. You don't speak French, of course, because you're English. And some of them probably succeeded. We don't know. I mean, if they succeeded, they didn't say anything, of course. But it was not unusual. Very often, they were not very sophisticated people. They had never lifted England before. And so they found them in a British Army uniform in Calais, looking lost, you know. And they were arrested and sometimes executed for desertion. And so this particular book took great detail of each case, a few hundred cases. Sometimes people were executed for murder or for other crimes, sometimes for desertion, for drinking on duty, you know, drinking as a sentry, you know, when you're supposed to be watching. And one of the main conclusions that they came to, which is perhaps not very surprising, was that more people were executed when the military situation was unstable. Yeah. So, for example, if the general felt that we need to shoot him to encourage the others, whereas for the same crime, 6 months later, when the military, you would not be shot. Yeah, so it was used as a military tactic. Fusillé pour l'exemple, littéralement. So that's one particular experience within the military. One of the interesting things about these is that it doesn't necessarily... They don't necessarily get praises from the people you would imagine. An excellent book, says the Daily Telegraph. The Daily Telegraph is a very conservative newspaper. Really very, very conservative newspaper. And the Daily Mail also... but they are also very interested in the First World War, and they are interested to see look at this one. A fascinating and moving book, The Daily Mail. However, The Daily Mail, you would imagine, and if you read their articles on the centenary, they are very, the British Empire was wonderful. Yeah. And yet they're also interested in exploring in detail all aspects. They want to be sure that they're being, in a way, being honest, looking at all the experiences. However, of course, even when you have all the facts, you still have a choice of interpretation. Yeah. Of interpretation. One of the big questions of interpretation was, on the one hand, people who say Britain was obliged to go to war because of the danger of German militarism, and on the other hand, people who say Germany and England were no better one than the other, yeah, that nobody was going to win. From the war, so more or less what the two possible positions there. A famous French example, Petroncini, Les Mutineries de 1917, been quite a lot of work done on mutinies. One of the fascinating things about the mutinies is that in the British Army there were mutinies after November 1918. Not before. That is, once the war was won, there were mutinies in the army because they wanted to go home and it wasn't moving fast enough. There were mutinies in the army because the government decided that a section of the army should go to Russia to fight against the Bolshevik Revolution. And the soldiers were not Bolsheviks, but they said, hey, what did they didn't do anything to me. I don't care. I want to go home. But in France, you had mutinies before, during the war, which is something rather specific and difficult to analyse. And interesting, Petroncini writes about the mutinies. But his position tends to be, we mustn't exaggerate the mutineers, there were not so many, it does not mean that he would tend to minimize the impact of the mutinies, whereas other historians would say it was a sign of a wider refusal. You may have seen the film, which way in the well, the film, The Christmas Truce. So this was a particular experience within the military. It's still military history. We're talking about soldiers. It's still military history from below. We're not interested in the generals. We're interested in what happened and to people, really. And this is the Christmas Truce that in 1914, in many parts of the front line, British, probably French too, but I don't know much about France, British and German soldiers stopped fighting for Christmas Day for a few days, played football, had a party, this is a study of how that could happen. And what's particularly notable about it is what we sometimes have the impression that there was one Christmas truce, not at all. This was in 20 or 30 different places independently. Because you can imagine, when the superior officer saw that his soldiers were not fighting, they kept it a secret from the others. The secret. So spontaneously, in many different places, they decided that, no, Christmas, we're not fighting at Christmas. And the superior officers were terrified. Because you know, it's not the kind of thing that you can make happen. Extremely interesting thing. One of the things that made it possible, in almost every case, the Germans began the truce. This does not prove that the Germans loved peace more than the English. It proves that the Germans spoke English and the English didn't speak German. The linguistic element was very, very important. Many Germans spoke English. Not the majority, but, 10% is a lot. But how many English people spoke German? I mean, how many English people speak German today? Not very, very high. So particular experiences, this is still military history, particular experiences within the military. Of course, particular experiences can be something else. The Price of Glory, a particular battle. There are a million books about particular battles. Probably not a million, but thousands of books. The Somme, Mons, Passchendaele, etc., etc., etc. And you can go through the book, you can go through the battle hour by hour, if you wish. Yeah. On the 31st in the morning, on the 31st in the afternoon. And that's a particular choice. Yeah, so the question is, why did the Germans not win more quickly at Verdun? Yeah? Or why did the Germans lose eventually at Verdun? So these are military questions, and those are questions for the historian, but it's a particular choice of question that's going on here. Now, military and diplomatic history then will continue. There is a difference between university history and bookshop history. In the universities, the popularity of military history will decline somewhat. There's still plenty, but in the 1940s, you had a vast majority of books on the First World War were military history, the percentage has definitely gone down a lot. And in fact, you regularly hear complaints from people who say, universities don't study military history anymore. This is not true. It's just that where it used to be 80% is now 20%. So that people are unhappy. Now, that's the case in universities. However, for publication in general, this is not the case. If you go to the library, I went to the library in the small town my mother lives in. There are 1,000 books on history. 250 are on the First World War. In the library, not the bookshop, the library. 1,000 books on history, a quarter on one war. So you can see the importance of it. And inside the First World War, military. Most of it is military. That's very popular today. Of course, in some ways it can be considered to be more exciting. to read a history book about war and not about monasteries. Oh, I've got a book for you about monasteries. Yeah, it might be interesting, but it's a little more difficult to sell. Even today, in the 21st century, from the point of view of publishing, military history is still massively popular. I mentioned The Soldier's War, or a book like Bloody Victory, is still very successful. And this is still the history of battles. However, military historians today are almost obliged to talk about ordinary soldiers if they want to sell books, the ordinary soldiers. And this is partly just the democratic spirit, whereas in the past it was acceptable to think that ordinary soldiers were not important, that's no longer the case. Diaries and collections of letters sell very well as well. Now, we always used to complain that we had a problem with diaries. In the First World War, historians, we used to complain, we have a problem with diaries. What's your problem with diaries? Say, only the bourgeois write diaries. That was the idea. And in the 1960s and 1970s, this may have been true. There were many diaries by artists and poets and superior officers and generals and ordinary soldiers, well. Today, that is not the case. Today, there are many collections of letters and diaries of ordinary soldiers. Now, of course, the proportion is not good. Probably three-quarters of the diaries published are officers, and only a quarter ordinary soldier. But, of course, in reality, the army was 80, 85, 90% ordinary soldiers. But nevertheless, we now have a few diaries from every group. Professional soldiers, voluntaries, voluntary soldiers, conscripts. We have a little bit of everything now, so that's obviously quite a good thing. The other thing which is different from diaries is oral history. And especially in the 1970s, there was a massive movement of oral history. Because, of course, in the 1970s, well, if you imagine that people joined when they were 20 years old, between 20 and 25 years old. That means that by the 1970s, the surviving soldiers were 80 years old. And so there were a group of intellectuals who said, oh, let's interview them all before they all die, you know. Now, of course, the last one took a long time to die because the oldest one died at the age of 107 or something like that. Yeah? Harry Patch, his name was. And in France, it was Lazare, somebody, the last one to die. Incidentally, in Britain and in France, they talked to the last soldier before he died, and they said, we would like to give you an official national funeral with the great honour. And both of the soldiers said, no, we don't want one. That was a very interesting idea. A pity from the governments were very disappointed because it was a strong symbol. And of course, it was rather a coincidence that the two last ones both refused. But an interesting coincidence. They both said, no, we don't want your glorious funeral. So a slightly anti-militarist sort of touch to that. But in the 1970s, then, a whole series of oral history entitled, in particular, a series of books called Forgotten Voices. I think there were 10 or 15 books called Forgotten Voices produced in collaboration with the Imperial War Museum. So again, here we have the idea of forgotten. Yeah. People haven't been telling you the truth. There's something missing. Buy this book. Yeah. So very interesting, which may be true or may be not true. Yeah. Now, there's something very particular about oral history, and that is it's not the same as a diary, because it's what the soldiers thought when they were 80 years old about what happened to them when they were 20 years old. And this causes a couple of rather difficult questions. First of all, for example, about memory. Yeah? You can remember things wrong. Especially if you've seen a lot of films, you can imagine things and then persuade yourself that you really did something that you didn't do. but also your interpretation can change. I have been told by some historians that if you talked to First World War veterans in 1930, you got very different answers from when you talked to First World War veterans in the 1960s, because the Second World War changed the way that people looked at the First World War. So that doesn't mean that oral history is not interesting. It means that you must not forget when and why the questions are being asked and what's happening. You need to always see where the voice is coming from. There is another difficulty with these books in that they're normally selections. They make very long interviews. I will interview you for 3 days. And then I will choose 10% of what you say, the most interesting bits. Not the most interesting bits for the general public to sell a book. But from a historian point of view, that's a problem. It's the old problem with the news, yes? That if somebody dies because their daughter kills them with a hammer, it's on the front page. But if somebody else dies because their hospital's closed and they didn't get to hospital in time, well, it's on page 28. There's a whole problem of selecting information. Another option, still within military history from below, in the publishing sector, is this collection of books called VCs of the First World War. Do you know what a VC is? A VC is a Victoria Cross. It is the highest medal for courage. There were a few hundred Victoria Crosses given during the First World War. And this gentleman and some of his friends wanted to write a book with a chapter on every one of them. So this is a very particular view. This is probably the sort of project which would not be very popular with university historians, because as historians we consider that a little bit problematic. First of all, it's obviously a very patriotic view. I only want to talk about the people who won a medal. That's very specific. Qui est le droit? You have to understand this. They got quite a lot of them. VCs from Gallipoli, VCs from Arras and Messines, two more battles, VCs from Cambrai, VCs from the air, a lot of VCs there. So that was that's one particular option, which didn't really come from the universities, but it's on sale in the British Library. It's quite popular stuff. And otherwise, as I mentioned, the Forgotten Voices of the Oral History, original recordings of World War I survivors, with the difficulties that I mentioned. Max Arthur is the specialist. Some of these historians were more historians by passion than by job. I'm pretty sure it wasn't his job, although he made money from it by selling books. A very passionate guy. Forgotten war Voices, The Struggle to Victory. Forgotten Voices of the Somme. And interesting one, this one, actually, because he took all these interviews from the 1970s. Very, very, I mean, you're talking about, I think they interviewed 600 people or something for 10 hours each, and it's enormous, yeah. And so the books is a small selection. But this one was interesting because he spoke about what happened to the soldiers when they came home after the war. And so I liked that one. It was very, very interesting. A new idea. Okay, it was the battle, but then what happens? Could they talk to people about the war? And this is one of the big questions that when they looked at in the 20 years ago, the veterans, they got all the old soldiers together, and one of the things they absolutely noticed is that the vast majority had not spoken to their families about their experience in the war. They had found it impossible to talk about, which, of course, is interesting in itself. A very, very interesting book, that The Road Home, the afterword. But again, this is oral history. What happened when I came home? Remember, of course, the government had made big promises. Lloyd George said, we will build homes fit for heroes. Il y aura des logements appropriés pour les héros. And, of course, the problem is civil peace. on pourrait dire les promesses des gouvernements en temps de guerre, ça n'engage que sur les Québécois. And of course, as you can imagine, this priority, once the war was finished, was not so important. So that's the end of military history. So if military history has changed and made much more space for ordinary soldiers, it's still very lively today. It's still very very vigorous. Diplomatic history, on the other hand, is having a bad time this last 20, 30 years. Not so many books, of course, dozens, but not so many books about diplomatic history. One exception, recently popular book, which I haven't read yet. One of the good things about being a historian of the First World War is that you can, when people say, "Oh, this new book is out," you can say, "I haven't read it." Because there are 30 books every month, so you can't read them all. Whereas if you are a historian about Irish monasteries in the 16th century, and somebody says, "There's a new book," then you must have read it. Yeah, you're obliged to have read it. Yeah, so if you're a First World War historian, you have a good excuse. But a new book called The Sleepwalkers, Somnambule. Who are the sleepwalkers, do you imagine, in this story? The sleepwalkers? What's the sleepwalkers? What's the connection of the sleepwalkers with the First World War? Good idea, yes. Yeah. In fact, the idea of the book is all of the elite in Germany, in Russia, in England, moving towards a war without deciding to have a war, but just, you know, zombie almost, yeah. And so this is not only diplomatic history, but it's very much about diplomatic history, about saying, oh yeah, if this ambassador had been more intelligent, maybe things would have been different. Difficult question. A difficult question because, of course, it's not necessarily untrue. On the other hand, after 1900, Germany had the biggest industry in Europe, the strongest industry in Europe, the strongest economy in Europe, not Britain. Britain had the biggest empire in the world, but no longer the biggest economy. And so that was obviously a tension. Yeah, Britain maintained a very, very a superpower status because of its empire, but its economy was not as big as Germany. Germany had a big industry and economy and very little empire, a few little bits of Africa, not much. And so if there had been no war in 1914, which is quite possible, this tension would have had some results. It would have done something. It was a real strong tension. You can see the arms race between Britain and Germany in 1905, 1906, 1908. We need to build bigger warships. We also need to build bigger warships. Now, of course, the First World War was not inevitable, but some kind of conflict between Britain and Germany was inevitable. Some kind of conflict. Yeah, so we need more for our industry. We need an empire. You've got an empire. And your industry, you know, give us some. There was something definitely going on there. Okay. We have finished talking about military history and diplomatic history. Because, of course, the First World War is interesting because it's a war. Now people fighting and all those fun things. But also because it transformed everybody's lives. Everybody's lives in Britain, Germany, France, Russia was transformed by the First World War. It caused the Russian Revolution. Without the First World War, there would have been no revolution in Russia. Not in 1917, maybe 20 years later, I don't know. That's not a controversial point, yeah? The reason it was possible to encourage the workers in Russian to revolt is because they had had enough of the war. That was amazing. Yeah, and that was it. Bread, peace, and land. Those were the slogans of the Russian Revolution. Bread, peace, and land. It's not complicated. You don't need to read many books. Yeah, we don't have any bread. Yeah, we're fed up with the war, and we don't have any land. What's the problem? It was a very, very simple question. Yeah? In Britain also, a big transformation, because the question was, will the British Empire survive or not? And the British Empire survived. In fact, the British Empire became bigger in 1918. But it was very clear that the America was the new major superpower. That was the beginning of the end for the British Empire. So let's have a look then at the second big field of history that we're going to talk about. Number two, social history. Oh, sorry, that was oral history. Social history. Oh, well, that's nice, social history. Oh, I like social history. What is social history? Would you like to try a definition? Oh, yes. Good question.
Maybe school that turns around, you know, the social movements,
what makes society. That's certainly one important element that many social historians say, I'm interested in social movements. Trade unions, the suffragettes, you know, Irish nationalist movements. Yeah, political groupings of ordinary people who make society change. Not always, not as fast as they would like. So that's one element of it, the actual social movement. So it's almost one element of social history is the study of activism, whether it's suffragettes or pacifist or trade unions, which are important things. I don't think, you know, it's not controversial to say in the 1930s and 1950s in Britain, they worked a 40-hour week and not a 57-hour week like they did in 1900. It's not very controversial to say that the trade union is an important part of this change. That's one element. Anything else on what social history could be about the first? So in the First World War, you could have a history of the trade unions of the First World War. The trade unions got much bigger during the war. Oof. Absolutely massively bigger. There were lots of strikes in the First World War. Many, many strikes, more than before. Not strikes against the war, strikes for more money mostly. There was a big movement in Glasgow against the rent. Because one of the things that happened is that soldiers went away for the war and their wives were at home and had money problems, and the landlords, you haven't paid your rent, will throw you out. And partly because of the war, people say, oh, you know, you can see these people, their husbands are out to save the British Empire, and you're throwing them out. And there's a big movement, very powerful movement of women in Glasgow, mostly women in Glasgow, and they went on rent strike, they refused to pay the rents. And they won. The government passed a law saying you cannot raise rents. Rents are frozen. So that would be social history, social movement. Very interesting. Before the war, it would have been very difficult to get the government to freeze the rents. You can imagine, especially at the time, it was very laissez-faire, huh? And so there were some victories like that. Any other aspects of social history apart from the movements? You got any ideas there? Golfing? Golf? Oh, demography, sorry, not golf, demography. All right, okay, so population changes and so on. Yeah, that would be a link to economic history, economic and social history. Yes, that could be any particular things about the demography that could be part of social history. You're right, somebody wrote a book recently, a very interesting book recently, about housing in London during the First World War. Housing, yeah. Of course, there was not so much social housing at that time. And so the shortage of housing, the prices of housing, and so on. I'll tell you more in a minute. Let's have a look at sources. What kind of sources for social history? I'm not going to give you all... I don't have all the answers to these questions. I just have some good questions. What kind of sources for social history? What kind of questions? And what kind of methods? Now, this is always the question, and this is what I'm hoping... This seminar is an introduction to historiography. You're not supposed to become experts. But I'm hoping that when you present the book, you will be able to say, what kind of sources and why? What kind of questions and what kind of methods? So what kind of questions for social... Can you think of a question of social history? For the First World War. Just invent a question of social history.
For instance, the impact of
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so you get the impact of the war on particular groups. Women, Catholics, manual workers, civil servants, whatever. That is that very often social war, social history takes social categories. Very often social classes, but not always. So you have questions about, you know, how enthusiastic were ordinary workers for the First World War? That's a social... that's not a military history question, because you don't need to know anything about the military. It's a question about public opinion in a particular social class. And so, for that's always been one of the very big questions about the First World War. Who was enthusiastic? Because certainly, when the war broke out, there were thousands of people in front of Buckingham Palace saying, yes, long live the king. Yeah, we're going to war. But that's not very helpful, because historians do not agree about who these people were. Say, was this mostly a middle-class crowd and not really working class? Also, it's 3,000 people. That's impressive in a way. You know, you don't normally get 3,000, but it's only 3,000 people. So, you know, what does it prove? A few days before the war, there was a big demonstration in Trafalgar Square against war. With probably, 10 or 15,000 people, I think. But it has the same problem. Yeah, but was this, you know, was this just a bunch of intellectuals? Or we have the photographs. What do you look at in the photographs? Hats. Yeah, because the hats were very different from the middle class and the working class. The working class had their flat cap, casquette. And the middle class could have different hats, yeah. And that was a very, very... It was better than... And that was absolutely... Because if you were a worker, you couldn't wear a middle class hat, and vice versa. So you could look at the photographs of the demonstration and count the hats, you know. That's what historians do a lot of the time. We count hats. The equivalent. Yes, okay. So that kind of question. Women... What happened to women? Well, the women, of course, had to go into the factories, or wanted to go into the factories. Very large number of women left domestic service and went into the munitions factories, because domestic service, let me into a secret, is horrible. Nobody wanted, whenever they got a chance to work in a factory, which was hard work, instead of being a domestic servant, in general, women preferred. Well, thank you. So all of those would be... Now, so let's have a look at social history. And the first thing to do... So these are different questions. We're not interested in the generals. We're not really interested in the soldiers. We're interested in civilians, and particularly workers and women, that is to say, dominated groups, not the elites. We're not interested in the elites. Most social history is not about the elites. One of the first questions to ask is, why in the 1960s did social history become much more present? Most of the golden age of social history is in the 60s and the 70s. And so to understand this history, we don't have to understand only the First World War, we also have to understand the 60s and the 70s. More and more universities. The number of historians was multiplying, yeah, because every university has a history department, yeah? Now, why? That's another question. But in the 1930s, you've got Oxford, Cambridge, St. Andrews, a few universities. In the 1960s, you've got 40, 50, 60 new universities. First thing. Secondly, the students are different. What is the difference between students in the 1960s and students in the 1930s? History students, what's the difference?
Different backgrounds.
Yeah, and more specifically?
Those who did not have
Absolutely. If I do an interview here and I ask 1,000 people in Cathay, did your grandfather go to the university? And in Crete, you know, if you want to find the people in Crete University when their grandfather, which you doit y en avoir, I mean, pas beaucoup. Whereas at the Sorbonne, it might be a little bit more complicated, yeah? So the first thing is that it was much more democratic, yeah, it was much more. And so you got historians who came from working class backgrounds, like me. My father was a gas worker. And so it's not surprising that they were more interested in ordinary people. It's not surprising, yeah. And the last one we have to mention is that the ideas of Marxism were more influential in the 1960s, in the 1950s, the 1960s, the 1970s, than in the 20s and 30s. So many of the general, not about the First World War in general, but many of the famous historians from the 1960s and the 1970s were Marxists in Britain. E.P. Thompson, Eric Hobsbawm, Christopher Hill, the few famous historians, they were all Marxists. This was very much the case in France as well. There's a big influence of the French Communist Party. This is not the case in every country in the world, but for reasons which are not connected with the First World War and not connected with history, Marxism had, it was not a majority, but it was had a significant influence between 1950 and 1990. There are political reasons for this. The Communist Party was very strong in France after the First World War. Le Parti des 100,000 fusillés. En plus, c'est vrai. So even people who didn't agree with on everything, they're obliged to have a certain respect. Okay, so what does social history do? Well, mostly interested in civilians, even if very often social historians will talk about the home fronts. On dit en France, le front intérieur. But in fact, the home front is a rather interesting expression because nevertheless, it subordinates civilians to a military purpose. It says, what are civilians? They're another way of fighting the war. So it's not a completely neutral view, the home fronts. Of course, the civilians were involved in fighting the war, working in the munition factories and so on, but they also did other things. Yeah. For example, there were a very large number of strikes in 1915, 1916, 1917. They were not strikes against the war. They were strikes saying, in this war, the rich are making lots of money, and we haven't got enough. Yeah. We're working very long hours in the munitions factories, but we're being badly paid. So the strikes were to get more, but they were not strikes against the war. And otherwise, there is an attempt to evaluate the experience of other groups which are not in the army. Nurses, pacifists, priests, etc. How about that? Shall I do that again? Thank you. Okay. So there are a certain number of general works on the home front, All Quiet on the Home Front, an oral history. Okay doesn't mean the book is okay, it means I have written notes on it. Okay, an oral history, okay, so we talked about that, interviewing people. So in this book they interview a lot of old women. Forgot it was all interviewing old men. Interviewed old women, they learned a lot of different things. Yeah. But again, with all these rather delicate questions about oral history. And I think there's going to be a new exhibition in the Imperial War Museum of the First World War. It's going to open in July. And I think I remember them saying that all of the text in it will be things which were written between 1914 and 1918. And we don't want any text in it from oral history. For this reason that people telling stories 60 years later, we're not so sure about. So interesting historiographical point there. So general works on the home front. How Britain Survived the Great War. So it's a slightly patriotic title. Yeah. The home front of the Great War. Pictures, of course. But again, the home front is a military term. It's about the home front. So you could have books of social history saying, you know, how the rich got richer during the First World War. I'm imagining this book. That would also be social history, but it would be a different one. Having said that, in France there is a book, I can't remember who wrote it, Les Profiteurs de Guerre, un livre assez récent, Les Profiteurs de Guerre. So that's another particular view of it. So we move away from the idea of Britain survived the war or France survived the war, and we separate people out. These are all choices. History of the home front, as we in those comments. Oh. Blighty, British society in the era of the Great War. So this is a very influential book which does not have the word home front. So it's not an accident. And it has the word blighty. Now, blighty is soldier slang. It means Britain. It comes from an Indian word. I don't know why. It comes from a word in an Indian language, blighty. You can probably find it on Wikipedia, the answer to the question. British society in the era of the Great War. This is a very serious serious university historian's book. You can tell the difference. You have the university historian's book, have a bibliography with 100 books in them, usually. Also very popular, local history. Bradford in the Great War. Dover and Folkestone during the Great War. Newmarket local history of the Great War, 1914 to 1918. So you see here, people are very interested in what happened in their town during the First World War. Yeah, in Britain at least, very, very popular. The smaller the town, the more the people are interested. Yes, which is another way of looking at history, very local history. It's in some ways, it's close to family history, again, which is a rather special phenomenon. And this has been transformed by the internet, because you see that the first two were books, but the last one is Newmarket Local History Society website. And so what's the advantage of a website? So you send all the information you have from your family about Newmarket, and it gives the what you call crowdsourcing, and you can get the information from everywhere. Of course, you get more and more information. The problem then is how to interpret the information, because if you're not careful, you say, we want letters from the First World War. And so, now we have 35,000 letters. But to move from there to writing something new can be rather difficult. One more. Hove and the Great War. Hove is a small town near Brighton. Yeah, don't copy out all the titles. You'll never have time to read even the titles. One particular novelty of social history is the question of women. But I wanted to say first that social history transformed all of history, medieval history, even ancient history, and modern history and contemporary history. And in many ways, the First World War history was less transformed by social history. But the military history was still very, very influential. But the question of women, of course, there have often been complaints that history in general talks mostly about men. And of course, history of the First World War is even worse, because the soldiers were all men. The war was going to be won or lost by men. And so there was a big myth. And even today, there are not so many books. There are a few books, but not so many books about women in the First World War. There's still many things we don't know. So if anybody wants to write a history book. Women Workers of the First World War by Gail Braben is very influential book, I was rather surprised to see that this is practically the only serious university history of women workers in the First World War, but there were many millions of them, so it's a little bit, it's something a little bit unusual about that. That's the same book again. The Roses of No Man's Land. This is a book of nurses, about nurses. So perhaps we may be back into military history here. We were in between the two. Roses, no, they are the nurses. The experience of nurses in the Great War. It wasn't a lot of fun. There were lots of blood, not a lot of fun. The Roses of No Man's Land. But very, very interesting. First of all, there was a tremendous fear. This was a very traditional society. And they were terrified that if they had these nurses, well, the nurses and the patients would, well, you understand, yes, they're very, very moralistic, and so it was forbidden to give your first name to the patients, for example, just in case they fell in love with you. So we learned some very interesting things about the time. They're extremely strict. They were particularly terrified because the nurses were often from the elites. Les femmes doivent pas souffrir, elles ne pouvaient pas s'amuser à partir souvent bénévolat. Les parents et les enfants mangent. So very often there were women from the elites who went to become nurses, and of course they were nursing, mostly working class men, so that was especially dangerous. You know what those working class men are like, yeah, once they get started. So a very, very interesting story then, written by Lynn MacDonald, who's one of the women military historians, but this is intermediate, of course. And this one, which I'm not going to say too much about, because I think somebody's going to talk about two particular women on the Western Front, something that that shows some aspects of the war we didn't know much about. And this, I already mentioned, these diaries of Georgina Lee. One more, Munitions Workers in the Great War by Angela Walcott, which I haven't. And look at the propaganda poster there, on her their lives depend. Yeah, the lives of the soldiers depend on the munitions workers. Conditions in the munitions factories were not good, the chemicals were dangerous. One of the things that happened is that the women turned completely yellow. If you work with TNT, it's very bad for your health, and you actually turn yellow. They called them canaries at the time. At the same time, of course, there was something new for them. They're finding themselves, especially young women, because of young women who don't have children yet. Because, you know, very often you had to leave your hometown and go and live near the factory. So, you know, it was mostly young women. But, of course, then they had football teams and a lot of new experiences which throw a light on what society was like before. And that's the way that, in some ways, the First World War is interesting, not just because it's a war and people kill each other, that is interesting, but also because those are moments when the government needs to mobilize the whole society, and so things which we knew nothing about are suddenly interesting. For example, medicine, very, very interesting. What was the state of health of ordinary people in 1905? We don't know. Nobody cared. Nobody went to find out. But when people joined the army, They had a medical test for every soldier and statistics and so on, so we have much more information. It's also possible to have to counter social history, the history of organization. And certainly in other periods, now the study of trade unions has always been very important in social history. Bizarrely enough, there is almost nothing written about trade unions in the First World War. We know that the number of trade unions, the number of people in trade unions went up very fast. We know there were lots of strikes, but there are almost no books. And in fact, when I don't know if a book was from the... No, I didn't. When I looked in the British Library and I searched for First World War trade unions, and the logiciel, the program came back, did you mean First World War trenches? But it didn't understand the question. That's how few there are there. There's very, 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 very few things written, poor little anecdote. But there are books about some organisations. The Church of England in the First World War in 1930 by Alan Wilkinson. Alan Wilkinson was a member of the Church of England, very critical of his own church. Very, very critical of his own church. And more recently, there have been some new books which have... I'm not sure it's 1930, actually. That might be a mistake. I'm not sure about that. Have I got it here? Law and Labour, Le Mouvement Ouvrier, from Social History and Social Society. Never mind. More recently, there have been other books on the Church of England which have been less critical about the Church of England, and that's a big debate. Yeah, that's a big debate about the padres and the Church of England. Certainly, an important section of the Church of England was extremely enthusiastic about the war. This is a war of Christ against the Antichrist, etc. It also caused a certain number of theological problems. First of all, according to traditional Christian theology, what happened was that one of the most patriotic, jingoistic leaders of the Church of England said, if soldiers die in battle for England, they automatically go to heaven. Yeah. Now, this is not Christian theology. To be strict, that is heretical. Yeah. That Christian theology is very precise about to go to heaven, you have to regret your sins, etc. There's a certain number of things. And so there was a theological debate in the Church of England about this. And there were more debates as well, because in the Catholic Church, it was traditional to have prayers for dead people. You die, you have a big prayer. In the Church of also for a long time, in the Catholic Church, you pray. You say, my grandfather died 5 years ago, but I still say a prayer for him every now and then, because that's Catholic. In the Church of England, you didn't pray for dead people. The idea was, this is God's problem. God can decide. I must not intervene. But in the war, inside the Church of England, there are many different opinions, not like the Catholic Church, many different opinions. And in the war, the demand for prayers for the dead was very strong, and the Church of England completely changed its traditions. Okay, we'll pray for the dead, because the pressure was too great. There's one more. There was the question of reservation of the sacraments. In 1913, there was a different attitude between Catholics and Protestants and Anglicans about the bread, the communion. In Catholic Church, it's okay to consecrate the bread and then put it in your pocket and walk around with it, which means that when people are dying... I've got some here. There you go. And in the Church of England, it was not generally allowed to reserve the sacraments in this way. And again, the pressure was very, very high, and they began to accept the reserve of the sacraments. So you see that there are some rather strange results of the First World War in theological debates. If you get the impression that I have done nothing over the last 5 years except read books about the First World War, this is true. Okay, that's what my life has been doing. The Party of Patriotism, the Conservative Party in the First World War. Yeah, so you take a particular organisation and see what they did in detail. And of course, an organisation like the Conservative Party, of course, it's the government, but it's also a local organisation in every town, the Conservative Club. They organised meetings. What were the subjects of the meetings? Did they organise debates about whether it's a good war or a bad war? What happened in 1916 when there was a big campaign for peace now? Was the Conservative Party interested in discussing, or did they say, oh no? All these questions, these are questions of. Which of course would tell us something about the Conservative Party in general. It's almost an accident that we're talking about the war. Labour's Great War, and now this is actually cheating, because I mentioned that there were almost no books on the trade unions in Britain during the First World War, and here's an illustration. This is about America. This is a book about American trade unions during the First World War. There you go. That just to show you, when I searched for First World War trade unions, I got, did you mean First World War trenches? Which is the computer equivalent of, why are you asking me ridiculous questions? Okay. More social aspects of the Great War. This is a 1930s book, published in Germany. Magnus Hirschfeld was one of the leaders of the gay liberation movement in the 20s. The sexual history of the First World War. It's a little bit speculative as a book, but it's an interesting idea. That when everybody's life changed completely, send millions of men somewhere else, what happens to more intimate questions a whole book on the British working class and enthusiasm for war. Very, very difficult question. And the recent book here, The Stomach for Fighting, Food and the Soldiers of the Great War. So here, actually, we've gone back almost, to some extent, we've gone back to military question, but it's not really military in the same way. And in fact, if you look at the top, it actually says cultural history of modern war. We're going to talk about cultural history in a moment, and what is it, if we know what it is, I'm not sure. What makes this a little bit different is that it talks about food, yeah, the practical questions of how to feed an army, but it also talks about what kind of food did the soldiers eat before the war. Very often they ate better in the army. And also it talks about what did food mean to the soldiers. Because, as you know, food is not just something you eat, it's also something which has meaning. So, for example, in Paris today, if somebody phones you up and says, "Ah, allez, on va manger dans un restaurant chinois," it's not exactly the same as if they say un restaurant japonais. This is not because of the food, it's also because it has a slightly different meaning, which is why the Japanese restaurants, which are mostly run by Chinese people, can charge higher prices. There's a lot of meanings in food. And so that's something I'll come back to in a moment. Here, soldiers and the culture of caregiving. So the culture of caregiving, what is that? I'm not sure. So it's a little bit more difficult to, it's not just the nurses, but it's caring in general. Yeah. How do you care for people in your family when they're ill? How do you care for old people? These five of things. And in a moment, I will come on to cultural history. In just a moment.